the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, Jason Bond at Stoneville, Mississippi with another episode of the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast. Bobby Golden's here with me as always. And what we have today is an episode that we actually recorded a couple of weeks ago.
Last week.
No, it was 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And then with the storm last week, Tropical Storm Gordon, we decided to hold that and talk specifically about that storm in an episode.
Well, and Gordon, I guess, too, is kind of put everything on hold. We really haven't got a combine fired back up, at least here on the station, since all the rain come through.
Yeah, and I think a lot of folks are in the same boat. But, you know, as Delta-wide, I think we were fortunate. There were definitely areas that really got pounded by that storm. If you were under the hill, kind of from Chula up to Greenwood, on up, you know, Grenada, several inches of rain, a lot of stuff went underwater, and then over, you know, west and north, maybe not quite as much. So I think as a whole, the Delta did pretty well with what was forecast beforehand.
Right, but, you know, it wasn't any sense in releasing an episode talking about post-harvest weed control and soil fertility when, if you can't get a combine in a field, you're really not worried about fertilizing or spraying.
That wasn't on anybody's radar last week. So, you know, it's really active tropical weather season so far. You know, want to keep in mind those folks on the East Coast with Florence headed that way. That seems like a big, gnarly storm. Definitely want to keep those folks in mind. And then there's another one out behind it. And then whatever that depression is, or whatever they call it before it's a depression.
Invest. So, you know, when the last time I looked, there was four in the Atlantic that,
right,
depending on which way they turn, you know, you never know what's going to hit us.
Yeah, that one, I think it's just going to turn up into the North Atlantic. Helene, I think, is its name. The one that's called Isaac, it's kind of headed toward the Caribbean right now. So, you know, they can do some squirrely things once they get into the Gulf.
All right, well, that's enough about the depressing stuff and the hurricanes and tropical storms and all that. We're looking for clear skies and sunny weather to get us back on track and get harvest out. Corn harvest is the first harvest we have, so there's a lot of time in between when it gets cold and wet and damp from when we're starting to cut corn in August to September, and you always see grasses, pigweeds, all kind of stuff pop up. So I know it's been a while since we've talked about weed control, but when you're looking, I guess let's start specifically with corn because it's the first that comes off.
Okay.
What do you consider, how do you start managing post-harvest weed control for corn and do it budget-friendly and timely?
And we've mentioned budgets on here several times through the course of the summer, and that's going to be a tall hill to climb in this particular thing. That's an easy place to cut. It's out of sight, out of mind. You know, I've got this group of cornfields harvested. I'm going to go cut some soybeans, you know, 3 or 4 miles down the road. When I'm not thinking about those cornfields we cut last week, you know, I'm onward and upward to other things. So there's probably going to be a lot of that. But when you start to think about whole farm management, I mean, you've got to consider that post-harvest window for weed control, especially with corn, you know, with the early harvest date. I always tell people, you know, weed control in the spring, there's some consistency from one operation to the next. You know, it's gonna warm up, it's gonna get dry, we're gonna put burn down out, you know, depending on the crop, probably gonna use some kind of pre and then go from there. You know, corn, probably not using a pre unless it's a right there at planting. But this post-harvest thing, man, it's just a crapshoot.
Well, I think that depends. Are you on a stale seed bed system? Are you rowing up in the spring? There's going to be a different recommendation.
All those things.
You know, do you burn your corn stubble or do you shred your stalks?
What's your crop mix?
Yeah. Are you moving back to cotton now instead of soybeans behind that corn?
Is your farm scattered out around three counties or is it all in one block? All that stuff factors into it, and frankly, there's really no good way to make any kind of blanket recommendation for it because every operation is unique. Therefore, every recommendation for weed control in this time window has to be unique.
Yeah, you know, because depending, you might be a guy that likes to go out there and shred his stalks, double disc, hip it up, and then you're clean. Or you might be another guy that, hey, I'm going to mulch these corn stubble and leave me a ground clutter for as long as I can. You know?
Well, I mean, you think about it. If you've got, I don't know, a couple thousand acres of corn and you know, several thousand acres of soybeans, it's in your best interest if you've got a little bit of lag time between the corn harvest and the soybean harvest. It's in your best interest to go ahead and if you are, you know, stale seed bedding in the spring, so you're doing your primary bed formation in the fall, it's in your best interest to go ahead and get that done before you got to move down the road and start harvesting soybeans. Now, that's not necessarily best for weed control, but that's best for your farm logistics.
Yeah, and that doesn't even take into account the guys that might be trying to run a cover crop on those stale seed beds. So speaking of that, you said there's no magic bullet blanket recommendation because everybody's so different. But what are your thoughts on what weeds do you drive by that field and say, you know what, I'm not worried about that out there. We can get rid of it easy versus what do you, if you ride by your field, go, oh, dang, there's a lot of this. I need to do something.
The same, in my mind, the same two primary weeds that we would deal with if we were in the spring and not in late summer into the fall. It's Palmer amaranth, it's barnyard grass. And it's not always just barnyard grass. I mean, that's the one that's usually the showiest one. You know, a lot of that grass that you see in cornfields after harvest, it may be, you know, broadleaf sentinel grass or goose grass or something like that. But there's more than likely going to be some barnyard grass out there. And it's the one that we seem to have had the most trouble with this year, you know, controlling in our row crops. So that's likely the one that we're going to see the most of. So, you know, you asked originally the things that I look for. We've done a lot of different things. We've tried some different things, shredding the stalks, not shredding the stalks, disking, not disking. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of value in flailing the stubble and leaving it laying. All right. If you think about weed seed, you know, the zones of germination, you know, a pigweed specifically is going to germinate from about a half inch deep in the soil profile. It's not going to come up any deeper than that. The seed's not big enough. So hopefully through the course of the year, if you've had good weed control, you've had some Palmer germinate, you controlled it. So you kind of depleted that germination zone, and maybe a whole lot more won't come up until you do till it and stir up more seed, you know, up into that top layer of soil. So that mulch, I think there's a lot of value there, you know, and then, you know, in your arena, burning the mulch. I know you got some pretty strong feelings on that, and, you know, in my world, burning it would not be a positive thing either.
Well, you know, there's a lot of data out there suggesting that, you know, burning stubble is not really that great from a soil fertility standpoint. You know, most people like to think, oh, you're burning your organic matter off, which you are. You're burning your organic matter off. But in our warm, humid environment, how much was that going to give to organic matter anyway? From the standpoint that I don't like, especially if you're in a corn and soybean rotation, when you're burning that organic matter off or corn stubble, you're also burning 70% of your sulfur out. And we know that those two crops have a great demand for sulfur at the high yields we're going. So you see the sulfur deficiency creeping into the mid-delta because we've cleaned up the atmosphere and not got the sulfur depositions, but we've also burned a lot of our stubble to release a lot of sulfur as gas. So, you know, I'm not that concerned about P&K. The losses to P&K from burning are going to be the ash either moving off the field or what I tell a lot of people, sitting on their windshield when they drive by the field, hey, if ash hits your windshield, that's your nutrients that was in that stubble. So from that standpoint, it's pretty bad to burn if you could possibly lose 20% of your P&K to physical movement. But it's really the sulfur that drives the decision for me, that I want to leave that stubble out there for as long as I can to let it break down and the sulfur leach back out before I burn it. And I think one of the issues that dictates how things operate when we're talking about this time in the fall is I can leave that stubble out there until my retailer gets to me with his fertilizer rig. Because as soon as I get my P&K applied, I'm going to want to go ahead and disc that in and hip it up and move on down the road with my Stell seed bed system. So, you know, everything logistically dictates that we're applying our fertilizers in the fall to be more timely in the spring for planting. But I think that also dictates how long we can let that stubble sit out there before we put a disc in it.
I think we have to acknowledge that burning the stubble from an equipment operation standpoint, there's a positive aspect to burning the stubble. It's definitely a lot easier to get that back in a row if you don't have that thick organic matter out there. So there's give and take with it from the weed control, from the soil fertility, but then from the practicality of equipment operation too. So definitely don't want to gloss over that part.
Well, and you know, from your weed seed scarification standpoint, are you releasing something different by burning it than putting a disc in it?
That's harder to know. You know, it's hard to study. You know, back to the discussion about the fact that everyone's different during this time frame. My suggestion to folks when I've gotten questions about this is, you know, flail the stubble and then leave it laying as long as is practical for your operation. You know, if you've got a couple thousand acres of beans that you got to harvest, well, then you got to go ahead and do it. You know, if you got to move down the road to a different county or whatever, then yeah, you got to go ahead and do it. But if you're in a nice block and everything is conveniently located and you can leave it laying for 3 or 4 weeks before, you know, time dictates that you got to do it, then do that. And I think that, you know, what I'm hearing you say with the fertility aspect, it would kind of play into that too.
You know, we're thinking a lot about cover crops now for ground cover, right? To reduce weed emergence. Use your corn straw to do the same thing.
You can go out in those fields, and if you do catch a rain after that harvest, you know, if you find an area, you know, between the rows where you do have some heavy mulch, you know, that corn, the leaves and stuff laying on the ground versus you catch a little area that is open ground, you know, and you'll see new weed emergence, whether it's grass or palm or whatever, coming up in those bare areas and not in the areas with the trash on it. Everybody always asks about residual herbicides, and we do actually have some products labeled in this use pattern now, Direx being one. Direx kind of has some quirky rotation intervals that they, with 24 C's, they've gotten around some of that. There's other ones that, and I'm not mentioning any other specific products because there are some other ones that it's not really addressed on the label.
Gray area.
It's a gray area. So there's like a total, you know, a total pounds AI per acre per year. And it doesn't really specify, it has use patterns, but it doesn't specify, you know, do not do it during this time frame. So,
and I've always wondered when it says during a year, is that a calendar year or is that a cropping year?
Well, and it varies by label. Some say per cropping season and some say per year. So, you know, whether those are intentionally vague or if it's just different people writing labels for different companies, you know, it's probably the latter. Rewind the clock a few weeks. Say it's August the 10th. And you do put a residual herbicide out, if you do catch a rain to get it incorporated, which we, in at least right here where we are, we did catch some rains during the month of August.
We caught a half inch last night.
Right. But if you did catch a rain to get it incorporated, you're only going to get 17, 21, 28 days, something, you know, in that ballpark, depending on how hot it is, worth of residual control. So, you know, if it was August the 10th, well, now it's September 1st. Well, what are you going to do now? You know, yeah. You might have 60 more days of warm weather. Take Valor, for instance. If you put Valor out on August the 10th, Valor applied August the 10th does not look like Valor applied November 1, even though it is, you know, applied in a fallow system. Just the temperature is different. The rainfall is different. You know, we can expect long residual from a product like Valor if we put it out in the fall, not if we put it out in August, because August is still summer, and it's going to look more like it does when you use it in the crop, you know, in the spring.
Right, right. So you're saying temperature-driven, you know, breakdown that products. And just because we're applying them out of the cropping, I don't want to say cropping season with what you just said about labels, but we're applying them outside of when the actual crop is there.
After the combine has come out of the field.
After the combine is there, doesn't mean it's going to look like it does in a burn down application.
That's exactly right.
Right. Well, you know, it's, everybody does do it different. And what would you recommend to the guys trying the cover crops? I know I've heard you talk a lot about, you know, we can't grow a cover crop in our fields because it's too wet. When would you start planting them in August and hope for a rain? Or
we've struggled. I mean, there's no question with that. You know, in the research that we've tried to do with it, we've struggled getting those established. And then when we have gotten them established, we've struggled producing biomass with the interest of suppressing weed seed. I will say that when we've done that, you know, we've erred. I don't even know if erred is the right word, but we have tended to plant them in October. That's just generally when we start doing our fall herbicide work and things like that. So that's kind of when we've done it. I don't think there's anything that says you can't do it earlier. So one thing that we're going to do this year, we've got a block of soybeans planted, and they're still green right now, but we're going to drop some cover crop seed in those before the leaves drop. You know, and maybe those leaves will mulch the cover crop seed. Maybe we catch a rain on it and get it up and going. This particular test is looking at suppression of ryegrass. So, you know, hopefully we'll get the cover crop up and going before the ryegrass gets up and going. At least that's what the intent of it is.
Well, and I think one of the things that a lot of people fail to realize when you're going after, I would say, weed control issues with cover crops, rather than, you know, when 60 years ago when we talked about cover crops, it was for soil stabilization. Now we're kind of talking about them for weed control. Do you fertilize a cover crop to get the biomass? I think depending on your weed issues, and if you're trying to control Palmer and ryegrass, you almost have to, don't you?
Well, I think that, you know, budget's going to dictate that. I mean, no question.
But then you get to the budget, and where's the trade-off of if I'm going to plant a cover crop mix, fertilize a cover crop mix, wouldn't it have just been simpler to, or about even out spraying it?
Well, I think that would depend on the herbicide of choice and, of course, the fertilizer rate and, you know, various different things there. So there's a lot of maybe we're asking more questions right here than we're answering. But, you know, there's a lot of things to factor in. And when you distill it through the budget, particularly in a year like 2018, I know I keep saying this, but there can really be some hard decisions to make, you know, on a farm this time of year in a year like 2018.
Well, I know y'all always hear me say that the first decision made post-harvest is, am I going to fertilize or not? And I can't afford my fertilizer budget. Well, when you got to think about ryegrass control and fertilizer budgets, what does it look like if both of them get cut out? Because there was a lot of potash deficiency out there this year. Because we cut back last year, in anticipation of low commodity prices this year. So I'd hate for us to get into a cycle like we were in 2007 and 8, where we took a couple years off fertilizing. We still hadn't dug ourselves out of that hole. So I would just be cautious about when we look at those budgets, almost got to do it on a field-by-field basis and say, okay, maybe this one I'm good enough that I can step back in this spot, but I really need to put the hammer down over here on this other input.
So I assume you're talking about a building rate of fertility versus a maintenance.
That's right.
So how do you make that decision? Do you do it off of yield potential? And then if you do it off of yield potential, do you put the build rate on your highest yield, or do you put the build rate on the field that you're trying to bring up? Maybe it's a little bit below your average and you're wanting to bring it up a little bit.
Yeah, and that's the conversation you always get in with everybody, and everybody has a little different approach. I like to maintain those fields that maybe not be the greatest and put my inputs into one I know we can shoot the moon on. If you have collected data over a vast amount of time and you know this field is very productive, but it's got a low spot on the end. You know, historically, when we started the variable rate applications, we were wanting to make a field uniform. Well, I think after 25 to 30 years of that, hadn't made a lot of fields uniform, right? So what we have learned, though, is we can better use those inputs to make more money on the more productive acres. So I'm one of the opinion of let's push the productive acres, let's maintain the yield level on the lesser productive acres. Let's not completely cut it out and make it drop to the bottom, But if we can maintain this and push this, then our whole farm average is going to come up.
A phrase I use a lot is move the middle. And so what you're describing is moving the middle by dragging the top up a little higher.
Yeah, basically you're moving the bell curve to the right.
Right.
You know, instead of try to widen it out or narrow it, you're moving it. So moving the middle is precisely what I think we need to be considering. And there's a lot of factors that go into that, not just fertility, but, you know, one of the things that I always think when I drive by a field in September and you see a 6-inch tall pigweed with a seed head on it, is that viable? I mean, is that making more seed or is it not going to make?
It can make seed. The data that's been collected on that, you know, in that time frame says that once the seed head comes out, it's 14 days to a viable seed, assuming it's a female plant and gets fertilized from a male plant. So, yeah, you're not making the 200,000 seed or million seed that, you know, a lot of times you hear people talk about the potential that a single female palmer has. But, you know, if you've got 1,000 little 6-inch tall palmers making 20 or 50 seed a piece, at some point, then that's a significant contribution back into your soil seed bank.
Well, and then maybe you look at those fields and you go, is it $15 to $20 that I extra spend on fertilizer, or do I take care of those pigweeds?
Right. I mean, I think we're speaking the same language as far as do we do it or do we not do it, and what's the optimum, you know, way to get there. But, I mean, P and K, I assume that's what we're talking about when we're talking about fall fertilization. So what's the optimum timing? All things, you know, everything else held constant. If all you had to do was worry about the optimum timing for P and K application in the fall, what would it be?
If you could do it the way I'd want to do it, I'd put it all out in the spring, because you're always better putting it closer to when the crop needs it. But logistically, that just doesn't work for us. You know, in a stale seed bed system, just doesn't work logistically. It doesn't work logistically when we're pushing planting windows into March. You see, if it's dry enough to plant, we want to plant, right? So I feel like if you can get it out, whenever you can get it out is fine, because we're really dealing with a retailer-driven logistic issue there. A lot of people have their own equipment to apply, but far more have retail applications. Get it in, get your beds hipped up.
Would later be better than earlier?
I don't necessarily know. In the testing that we've done, we've looked at fall application versus spring application, and not so much as what timing in the fall we put it out. So what we do know from that data is that for corn and soybeans on soils with CEC above 13 or 14, you can put it out in the fall or spring. And we don't see any difference in efficacy. Where we see a difference is when we get on soils less than 14, 12, 10, definitely below 10, we get better utilization of those nutrients when we do put them out in the spring. And then on our rice soils, you know, that have a pH above 7.5, we really need to consider moving that phosphorus application into the springtime.
So if we're doing it in the fall, then what I'm getting from you is do it when it's practical.
That's right. Do it when it's logistically practical for your operation.
And so then tie that back to weed control. It's basically the same thing I said. In corn, if you can leave the stubble there, leave it there as long as practical. I don't want to make any suggestion to somebody that messes up their logistics or it's not practical. I mean, it's just, that goes against my grain. And I know that this time of year, the stress level is even that much higher.
Well, I think, you know, most people get stressed out at planting, but I think a lot of people discount the stress level that's not involved in farming that's going on this time of year, because not only are you trying to get the crop out before the weather sets in, but you're also seeing these markets slide down and you're trying to do numbers and math in your head on your non-booked acres.
Yep.
It don't make for a lot of happy people right now.
That's for sure. All right, guys, we're going to jump off, but we appreciate your time. If we can do anything for you, just give us a call and we'll get out to you as soon as we can.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.